All right. I'm Leif Dormstrom. I'm the vice chair of the safety committee. I'll be running the meeting until the chair arrives. Before we get started with the meeting, which consists of basically several informative updates, Pat, can you give us the safety contact?
Sure. Good morning. Just as a reminder, the closest emergency exits are to my left and my right behind me. There's also fire extinguishers in those hallways. If we need to exit, we're going to go through the lobby and across the street and rally at the museum. There's an AED and restrooms in adjacent to where the security guard is by the turnstiles going by the elevator bank. So this morning, safety contact is going to be on emergency preparedness. September is National Preparedness Month. As a reminder, each of us has a responsibility to be as prepared as possible for emergencies, whether a natural disaster which may come in the form of a hurricane, a blizzard, etc. There are many things that individuals, families, and communities can do to improve their preparedness. Please visit the website www.ready.gov, which provides strategies to be more prepared. That is our Homeland Security website. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. We'll defer the administrative items until we have the presence of a Virginian, and subject to some changes offered by the Virginia member. The agenda will look like this. First, we're going to get a report from Mr. Charles Joseph from APTA. He will provide an overview of the APTA peer review of Metro's third rail and infrastructure that had been requested by WMATA earlier this year. Good to see you, Charles. Thank you very much, by the way, for your peer review of the streetcar last year. After that, we'll receive an update on the self-evacuation incident that occurred near Farragut North Metro Rail Station last week. And then the last item on the agenda will be a committee. The committee will receive an update from Mr. Lavin on Metro's progress addressing the actionable items from the FTA and recommendations from the NTSB. So with that, Charles, would you like to walk us through your presentation? Thank you.
Good morning, members of the WMATA Board of Directors. In July this year, at the invitation of Paul Wilderfield, we did a peer review regarding the third rail power and infrastructure. The review was conducted through a series of briefings by staff, interviews, some documents were looked at, and some visual observations. At the conclusion of that review, we presented to the senior managers of WMATA an exit conference with a slide presentation, which we will repeat here today. At the request of WMATA, we are also pleased to be here this morning and repeat that presentation. The peer review panel was made up of rail transit experts from various transit agencies throughout the U.S. who voluntarily gave up their time to be here. APTA's role was to review, facilitate that review, and I'm pleased to see that we've got two out of the five peer review members here today: Vernon Hartzog, chief engineer from MTA Maryland, and Anthony Fazio, the manager of engineering and design for Concepta. Should you have any questions at the end of this presentation, we'll be happy to note it and provide a response in time. So the first observation and recommendation, we'll go through this, but in the interest of time, and I think you have a copy of the slide presentation, we'll just talk about the recommendations for each of these. The first one we looked at was one of the substations at random, and we suggested and recommended that there's some housekeeping that needs to be looked at and improved. Current requirement, of course, is that the mechanics...
Oh, that's better. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Every 14 days, the mechanics do a review of the maintenance of the substations, and it's checked on by the supervisors every 3 months. We need to make sure that a new initiative is in place to identify and remediate rooms in need of major cleaning and debris removals. On organization, there are several observations, but if I can just jump down to the recommendations, we need to establish clear lines of responsibility. Some of the things that we heard, if you move to the next slide, which says recommendations, to establish clear lines of responsibilities, we found that some people weren't sure what their role and responsibilities were. Review, we are recommending that WMATA review staffing levels where departments and there appears to be some imbalance between departments. We're recommending that you look at that. The team was not able to, because of the time factor, to delve into any great detail and verify the statements that were being made by staff. In addressing recommendation B, we commend WMATA Human Resources for hiring an external consultant and working with the Traction Power folks to define these roles and responsibilities. We also have subsequently found out that a formal training program has been reinstituted, because that was one of the concerns that was expressed by staff. We also understand now that a manpower assessment study has been completed with recommendation to ensure that personnel requirements for Traction Power maintenance folks are adequate. Again, this is another proactive action that WMATA has taken, and they should be commended for it. Slide number three, various departments are siloed. We heard that some of the siloing effects may have a detrimental effect on the procurement process from cradle to grave. WMATA is currently evaluating some of the engineering functions with the possibility of moving them from operations that side of the house. And we encourage WMATA to look at this communications line, which we heard that people are not getting the information they need, or if they are, it's coming through various other channels. So that's something to look at and make sure that there is a point of contact for each of these departments. Moving to corrosion control, I'm going to turn over to Vernon Hartsock, our chief engineer from Maryland, to talk about that slide.
Good morning. I will give a very brief explanation of what we're speaking about. When we refer to corrosion and mass transit, we're not talking about the rust that's seen on metal. Typically, that's what we think of as corrosion. This is another form of corrosion called stray current corrosion. And in a brief description, what you have, your substations are essentially a battery with a positive and negative terminal. The positive terminal connects via cables and so forth to the third rail. The negative terminal connects to the running rails, the track. And as long as all of the current flows in the circuit that I just described between the substation, third rail, the train, running rails, you have no problem. This exists only when that electrical system is fully isolated from earth ground. However, if anything occurs that compromises the isolation of the negative part of the circuit, which includes your running rails, the conductors that attach to them, parts of the impedance bonds, many systems elements in the railway that are tied to the negative part of the circuit, if there's a compromise to the electrical isolation whereby a path, an electrical path, is established to earth ground, this creates an opportunity for stray current to exist. Stray current essentially is current that does not flow through the circuit I described, but rather it exits somewhere along your negative circuit, your rails, your cables, travels through the earth, and then back on another path toward the substation. The problem is, when stray current flows through the process of electrolysis, it degrades metal. Just briefly, if you have 1 amp of stray current flowing through iron, in 1 year you'll lose 20 pounds of that metal through this process of stray current. Stray currents are typically small, much lower than an amp, but over time they cause destruction. When we saw the videos of the explosions and the testimony of glowing bolts, it was clear These things are caused by stray currents. Stray currents, again, flow when the isolation is compromised, when you have dirty insulators, when you have conductors whose jacket is compromised and the conductor's touching ground, or when the rails themselves are in contact with ballast that's not clean. These and many other situations cause an opportunity for stray current to flow, and this is the underlying cause of all of these problems with fires, explosions, glowing bolts. These are electrical principles. There's nothing mysterious about them. It's fundamental electrical issues. Now, corrosion control is the practice of testing the electrical isolation of your rail system and performing remediation work to resolve any problems, such as dirty insulators or fasteners that are shorting out or dirty ballast. This corrosion control testing is essential that it be done system-wide and that it be done on a periodic basis so that we test, we see areas through the testing where isolation is compromised, remediation work is then scheduled to fix the problems before they manifest themselves in the form of explosions and fires. So the recommendation in this particular area is that in addition to testing that you do now at the interlockings, that this testing should be done system-wide, and that should include both the running rails and the contact rails, and that you should establish essentially a baseline condition for your entire system, repair areas that are in need of attention, and then determine a proper interval at which this testing should be repeated on a periodic basis to keep the system in a state of good repair and to maintain this electrical isolation. Lastly, again, we believe that this is a significant cause of the underlying cause of these fires, explosions, and all of these electrical issues because of the extreme amounts of current WMATA uses in the system due to your high volume of service, and this is our recommendation.
Thank you, Vernon. Moving on to the next slide, which talks about the track geometry vehicle and the thermal imaging, I've asked Anthony Fazio from SEPTA to speak to that slide.
Morning, everybody. Speaking about the track geometry vehicle, it exceeds the industry standards. So there's no recommendations as far as track geometry goes. It also has a device that produces thermal imaging. It looks for hot spots. The only problem with that device on the track geometry vehicle is the vehicle is self-propelled. It doesn't draw any current from the traction power system. So what WMATA has is they have thermal imaging attached to the revenue vehicles, and that's highly commendable. There's two issues with that, and Mr. Levin has some solutions, I believe, in place. And right now, the thermal imaging is set too high away from the third rail and away from the traction power system, and it's set on the front of the train. And so the recommendations are to move it to the back of the train so that you're drawing the most possible current through the rail. The current's going to look for a weak spot, loose connection, as Vern spoke about. So if the train already passes, the thought process is you're already going to be heating up the third rail. So the next phase of that would be to get parameters established. The thermal imaging, it basically takes color codes and it assigns colors to temperature. So parameters would have to be established as to what's too hot, what's going to send a track inspector out to look at the condition, what's going to shut the line down, what's going to get passengers off the train. So that's one recommendation. The other recommendation would be real-time data, a methodology to get that data directly to frontline supervision to look for a problem or directly to dispatchers. And there was one last leg of recommendation that we made, and that was that there are some handheld thermal imaging cameras. So what we proposed was those cameras go to frontline employees so that they can go out and physically inspect a red flag, so to speak, of a problem with hot third rail or hot insulator or hot rail return in the traction power system. So that would slide four and five. And that would bring us up to third rail cover boards.
So on the third rail cover boards, this is the cover board that actually goes on top of the current rail, the third rail. We had some visual observations of a sample cover board in the rail yard, and we believe that the securement of that is adequate. What we're recommending is that two things. One, just verify, and we weren't able to verify because I think it may need some specialist requirements. Verify that the material of the cover board is in compliance with NFPA 130, which requires for low smoke, zero halogen materials to be in there. Now, currently, the cover board has, where two of them join together, they have a bolt that goes through, a mushroom-type bolt, and then they have a cotter pin underneath, which secures the two together. While this is considered adequate, WMATA may want to consider, like some of the other properties do, whether that's okay or whether you put one the other way, where the mushroom goes up and you put a nut on top. There are merits for both sides, and this is one that has to be looked at. But the important thing is, when the track walker walks along, he cannot see this cotter pin, whether it's in place and whether it is secure, because he's up here, the cotter pin's down here, and it's not easy for him to look at that, or her, if I don't know if they have women that go out, but whoever it is, the track walker. So that's something we are recommending that may want to be looked at. And also, very important is, WMATA should identify the causal factor as to why several cover boards are failing, and have a plan in place to address them. On the third rail, for quite a while, the orange boot has been used extensively for many years at WMATA. And when WMATA started using eight-car trains, they've, of course, upgraded the substation, and they've also upgraded the cabling that was required. Our recommendation is that we reevaluate the orange boot and consider whether that is the optimum. Some properties have it, some properties don't. And some properties just use lower, smaller conductor cables that feed the third rail. But given that you don't have track switches to do isolations, we thought you might want to consider bolted type exothermic connections to the third rail. Moving on to the state of good repair. Based on interviews, managers always considered themselves in a constant catch-up mode, trying to catch up with their maintenance and inspection. We're recommending that WMATA considers, and I know there's a dollar value attached to this, some planned overtime for maintenance programs that will assist in getting a baseline for the state of good repair done. Now, in order to catch up with some of this work, we understand that some of the cable work replacement has also been done by external personnel, and that'll be very helpful. Something else you might want to consider is, when you do capital program planning, consider other users that could use the same work zone to work within, whether they're systems or whoever else that can use that same piece of work, that same time allocation. And did you want to talk a little bit about that, too?
Yes, thank you, Charles. Just to elaborate a little bit on recommendations, some of the older systems, like New York City Transit and some of the older rail systems, heavy rail, too, they'll just create a fund specifically for cable replacement, and they'll go through and they'll test every single cable, prioritize, whether it be a tunnel or an overhead structure, what's more important from a fire life safety aspect. And then they'll piecemeal cables in, and it's a little bit difficult and troublesome because you have to jump from one line to the other, to this line, to that line. But it's a way of chipping away at some of the old cables and not having to worry about the rail return and the energy getting back to the substation. So I just wanted to elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay, moving on to asset management. During staff interviews, it was not clear to the peer review team that they clearly understood, or if they did understand, they didn't articulate that, the parent-child task in Maximo. That is, you have an asset, you have a maintenance task attached to that asset. As an example, they had a rectifier maintenance as the asset instead of a task. So we're recommending that that we look at, that WMATA looks at the Maximo system, make sure, which I believe some of that work is in process already, to make sure that there is an upgrade and configuration program to correctly associate these components and their relationships. Cabling is another example. They're just shown as a cable without further description, whether it is a power cable, what size it is, what the capacity is, and such like. On the third rail, insulator cleaning practices, we found that the third rail insulators, both in the yard and in the where the trains move at very low speed and in open deck areas, were quite dirty, quite filthy and soiled. In tunnels, of course, you would expect some of that because of the environment. We'll be asking WMATA to look at it, to perform an analysis of the deposits on these third rail insulators and determine where it's coming from and if there is anything that can be done to rectify. Soiled insulators, of course, pose a higher likelihood of arcing and a point of failure. Now, there was one agency that, and we have photographs in the report that you have access to, where they have curb brushes and they clean with water and things like that with wooden handles or fiberglass so that it doesn't conduct any electricity, that cleans these insulators. They do it with power on. That's something that you might want to look at. But they have done it for years and done it successfully. All we're saying is that just look at what cleaning methods are available out there with other agencies and consider that. The Rail Operational Control Center, the controllers there have a large task on their hands. An engineering staffer stated that the workload of these controllers, they're unable to obtain track allocation in a reasonable time frame. Now, what does that mean? It means that the non-revenue hour period that you have is shorter every time there is a delay in being granted track allocation. Historically, staff have been somewhat hesitant to start work if they know they cannot finish it before the first passenger train. Based on these and other related recommendations, WMATA has asked APTA to do another peer review regarding the Operation Control Center to gauge performance against industry practices and examine its organizational structure, the training, the resources available, and any other observations and recommendations. And that's been scheduled for sometime late in October. And moving quickly on, data collection, let me just run through that very quickly. Data collection is vital to any organization, that goes without saying. But there is a ton of data, and we're not sure that it's being used in a meaningful way and by those who need to have access to it. So just be aware of that, and we put that down as a recommendation, and that's a big job. Review comments. This is where you have design or procurement going out and people and the procurement departments or the engineering people would have 30, 60, 90% design submittals at various stages and you solicit comments from the end users. Staff didn't believe that this was being consistently done, and they felt somewhat slighted on occasion where things were procured and it didn't meet the need. And one example, I believe, was, I'm looking for it here, I think it was to do with, I can't find the example, but it was
The overload relays,
thank you, where it was procured and it didn't meet the need. Now, folks, these are our observations and recommendations of this review, and it is intended to assist WMATA in strengthening the safety and effectiveness of their third rail power and infrastructure and any associated inspections and maintenance program and strategies. The peer review team sincerely appreciates the opportunity to assist and extend the throughout the peer review and extend an invitation for us to be able to assist WMATA at a later date with any clarification and subsequent support needed. This concludes our presentation.
Okay, we've got some time for questions and answers. I'm going to allow the members of the committee the privilege of asking questions first. Michael?
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. That was a very informative report, and I look forward to actually reading the whole thing when it becomes available to board members. The first series of questions I want to ask you is that your recommendations seem eminently reasonable, and I assume in your making them, they are what you all consider to be industry best practices. Is that correct?
Yep.
Is there anything in terms of your recommendations that would be on the, you know, fringe or the outside edge of industry best practices that would be fairly controversial from an industry best practices standpoint that you're recommending?
One was to do with the cleaning of the third rail insulators with the power on. One property does that. I think it is Chicago, isn't it, CTA? Now most people would balk at that because the power is on and you're using water. But again, that's on the fringe. Not everybody does that. But that's one example. Do you have another?
The thermal imaging on the equipment is way beyond the industry standard. I worked for the railroad for years. Our thermal imaging was a third rail supervisor on the front of the Long Island Railroad train, holding it on the tunnel. So, and then to take it one step further, like we discussed, that's pretty much cutting edge to have real-time data, and it's a fantastic idea. On the part of your staff, I should say.
Thank you. I mean, other than those two, since these are basically industry best practices, and I'm sure they've been industry best practices for more than 24 or 48 hours, they've been there for many years. Do you have any insight from your interviewing of staff why these industry best practice recommendations have been implemented in the last 5 years, the last 3 years by WMATA?
Yes, please.
Well, I'd like to hear from the,
sure.
The gentleman
some,
first.
Some of these have been implemented.
I'd like to hear from the gentleman first. then I'll answer to the other gentleman. How do you New Yorkers always get want to get in there first?
I think, let me frame it this. We don't know the answer why staff are not doing it. But in our defense, we had Monday afternoon and all day Tuesday to do visual observations, and Friday we did interviews. So it was a day and a half, and, you know, we could only cram in so much, and even in the interviews, we only had a limited 20-minute slot for each of the staff members, and some of them, of course, would like to talk and talk, and, you know, it's kind of difficult to shut them up because they want to feel that they're important to this process. And they had a lot to offer. But to answer your question, we didn't get that from them. We didn't ask them that either.
Okay, Pat, New Yorker. Go.
So some of these programs are already in place. They exist. For example, if you talk about Russell corrosion testing, at one time it was done throughout the system. And it actually, there was a program in place where they would replace the fasteners in the station on some type of periodic basis. And the reason why they did the fasteners in the station is because they're the most subject to traction power return stray current issues. Because you have trains coming in, it's introducing regenerative braking as they stop. As a train leaves, you have a propulsion drawer, so that area in the station is most subject to stray current. That system got defunded in the past. It got scaled back. It's only done now at interlockings. So that's you know, so what I find is you have a lot of intelligent people at work here. They come up with very good programs. They implement them, and then they seem to some degree get scaled back or suspended. So a lot of these industry best practice were being done at WMATA, and we'd like to revive them.
Hi, good morning. Sorry to be late. Sorry I missed the presentation. Are there other questions from anyone? Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Carmody. So just one question about slide 10, the third rail cover boards. I was a little curious, Mr. Joseph, when you said that it's difficult to verify the actual materials. Is that a function of an inadequate asset management system that we're not able to figure out whether or not those cover boards are compliant with best practices? Or is it something unique about the cover board itself that makes it unable to identify its manufacturer, its composition? It seems like that should be something that we could fairly easily ascertain. Anyone who can answer. Thank you, Mr. Levin.
Okay, so if you look at the slide, it talks about an NFPA 130 standard. When you typically buy a protection board, it's built to a different standard, which is like an ANSI standard, which has a very defined characteristics. It's not designed off of an NFPA 130 standard. So what we are doing now is we have our quality assurance people doing a crosswalk, the ANSI standard versus the NFPA 130, and see where we line up. But there is a defined standard, it's quantifiable, it's documented, and I can provide it if you like.
So that's just going to be a matter of just a little bit more work to figure it out. It's not something that's beyond our grasp to figure out.
Correct.
Okay.
It's more of a function of a crosswalk to see where they line up.
Okay. Thank you. That's it.
Yes, we are trying to move on and move through this section quickly. There are a couple more questions from my colleagues, and perhaps they can ask the questions and the response can be provided later.
Just a couple observations. First of all, when you talk about some of the organizational issues, you've talked about some of the folks don't know exactly what their responsibilities are. You also hinted that some may not be qualified to do those jobs. And you've also talked about training. Isn't training the key to understanding what your job is and how to do it?
I agree. What I think somewhat gets lost in this is if you look at the function of the track department, they also provide the role of the third rail maintenance and inspections. So I think what the heavier emphasis in the training is the track walking function of what they're supposed to do as a track walker. I'm not convinced that we're putting enough emphasis on the third rail side of this for gauging third rail, inspecting third rail, identifying proper cable connections. So that's an area I think we need to focus on.
All right, just a couple of other observations here, and then we'll go on. When you talk about corrosion, this is basically through current leakage and some of the other recommendations, the determination of hot spots, the look at the orange boots to see if the orange boots are appropriate, the look at insulator cleaning. This is all the same issue. This is all about current leakage. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. These are fundamental electrical properties. Just simply put, when you have contamination, dirt, it provides a path for current. And if that path is anything other than the circuit I described earlier, it is stray current, and it will cause damage.
So Washington Metro, you went and assessed their program. Did they have appropriate program to control any of this?
There was a demonstration that this program is in effect at interlockings, that in the past, I'm aware that it was system-wide. The recommendation is to reinvigorate it system-wide, not only the testing, but the follow-up remediation work to correct the items identified in testing.
Okay, and just one more observation here. I think I want to congratulate the decision to go ahead and look at the operations control center. Everything that happens on Washington Metro begins and ends at the control center, and I think a peer review of that operation would be most helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Lobby, Pat, could I point out that you guys are also running longer consists, drawing a lot more electricity than traditional. So more tonnage, more demand for maintenance, and then more electricity that has to get back to the substation also has an effect on all the above.
It's a greater propensity for stray current, given the significant volumes of current that WMATA uses as compared to other transit properties. It exacerbates your problem.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Costa, you had a quick question.
A couple of quick questions, and I'm looking forward to reading the detailed report because I'm assuming that the detailed report might answer the questions. Going back to recommendation 8, capital program should be systems-based. I think what I heard was that oftentimes we're formulating our capital program based on area and location versus system-wide. I just want to make sure that I heard that correctly.
Can I respond to that? What we were talking about was if a project is developed that's going to cause a work block in a section of the railway, what we were saying is while you're doing this one item, it would be perhaps advantageous to look at what else could be in that work block, what else could you address at the same time.
I think just to add to that, a lot of that is being done now in the safe track, where we're trying to get the most bang for the buck in that geographic area with different departments fixing different assets.
Okay, thanks. That's what I assumed you were talking about, and beyond safe track, that's how we should formulate our capital program. Second question, recommendation 13, it seemed to relate to the procurement process. It describes end users. Who are end users from the standpoint of your perspective? Because that's, I'm assuming that's not passengers.
I think by end users we meant the department heads that are actually responsible for the maintenance of the
program
infrastructure.
Program folks.
Yes. Well, program folks would be the people putting out the 30, 60, 90% plans, running the construction or running the large capital program. But what we envisioned, and we had some evidence it was going on, but others weren't aware of it, is that those people are routing plans to the department heads for maintenance of way.
Right.
The ones that are responsible for day-in-and-day-out maintenance, and I think we're referring to them as the end users.
Okay. So that's a pretty typical problem in construction world, kind of the disconnect between who's planning projects and who actually has to operate and maintain, and that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Hudgens, you had a quick question.
Yes, and it's very quick. I'm sorry I didn't hear the entire presentation, but in hearing the responses, and I think this may be to Mr. Wiedefeld and Mr. Lamon, that how do, from a policy standpoint, we as a board are able to kind of keep up with what changes are made as a result of some of these recommendations, and how do they remain consistent? Because I think from some standpoint, we feel like we've been there before, and we're hearing some of the same, not specific problems, but processes that are existing.
Okay. For me, I wanted to thank for all the members of the peer review for coming in and doing this work. There's three takeaways for me. One is it creates the work plan for Joe Leader and Pat. It outlined a number of things. The other thing that comes across to me is that we need to review some of the practices we've done in the past. Is it the best thing to do? And it reinforces potential the need for different type of investments. And the other thing that I hear is that we need more time, to do these types of inspections and do them correctly. So that's what occurs. And clearly, we had already moved on the rock to do a peer review there. And again, the goal here is to be transparent, to find out what we've got, and then to come up with plans to tackle it. So I will be bring back to the board what, physically we may need to do in terms of either investment and or time.
Thank you. I see a hand. Life.
I just wanted to concentrate my one question on the Safe Track program. From the APTA peer review team's perspective, were there any concerns on your part that the program of rehabilitation that's underway right now may be inadequate, it may be misplaced, It may not be kind of achieving the right results. I mean, we're halfway through this maintenance program, and as I look at, you know, all of your recommendations, not in isolation, but start to connect the dots between the recommendations, this whole issue of design review, procurement, installation, you know, the right materials and things like that, you know, begs the question, you know, if we're advancing all this work and accelerating it is great if it, we're accelerating the right solutions, the right outcomes, but you raise a lot of questions about the orange boot design, you raise questions about whether or not we're using the right insulators, you raise questions about the cable replacement program, you just raised another question about the cover boards. Well, if we're out there doing all this work, you know, are we doing the right work? I know your charge wasn't to evaluate the safe tracks, but can you offer any kind of guidance as to whether or not we should be concerned that we're going to be back in the same work zones over and over again?
In all of the interviews that we did, the only positive thing we heard from staff was we are really pleased that we've got SafeTrack here. There's an acceleration of work because some of these people, the maintainers particularly, they have some pride in the work, and if the maintenance is not getting done, then they feel it's their problem. But they see SafeTrack has a way to get all of the and accelerate some of this work. So we only had positive comments from them, and nothing in our interviews or observations told us that WMATA was doing anything that was not correct. So we're pleased to report that, and that's an observation we made and from what we heard from staff. So they were, I wouldn't say they were ecstatic, but they're very pleased that SafeTrack is there and they can get work done, and they can say, my piece of work, we're up to speed.
Thank you. I think that's all. I'm told we need to approve the minutes because there wasn't a quorum at the beginning. So could I have a motion to approve, please?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
So opposed? So moved. Now I'd like to move quick, and thank you, gentlemen, very much for the presentation. There were a lot of questions because it was interesting and because we had you here.
Anthony, I'm sorry to get your name wrong. Yes, Aaron.
Mr. Lavin, I think we'd like to move quickly into the presentation on the incident last week.
Okay, so we're going to discuss the self-evacuation at Farragut North Metro Station. So this provides a timeline of the incident. The duration of the incident was approximately 32 minutes. Approximately 18 minutes into the incident is when the first individual was identified to have self-evacuated. I think it would be informative if we really treat this as two distinct events because we need to understand why the switch failed first, and then we need to understand the secondary, which was the train 101 entering the station. So on that night, and I think we can go to the next slide. Okay, so on the night of the incident, if you look at the candy striped work zone at the top of the screen, that individuals had taken that track out under a red tag to perform work. Prior to the incident train 101 arriving, you had a non-revenue train enter Farragut North Station. That train was routed into the pocket track. The intent of that train was to change ends, go back, because it was being transferred from one yard to another yard. The signal configuration in that area is that if you put a train into the pocket track, it triggers 7 switch to go reverse. 7 switch had been clamped to secure the track. So as a function of being clamped and the switch being triggered to be called reverse, it blew an operating fuse on a switch. The switch came out of correspondence. I know it's a little technical, but essentially the switch attempted to operate. It could not operate because it was clamped. It blew a fuse. It took the switch out of correspondence. Now, there was the rail control center was responsible to put a block on that switch, which is called an auxiliary command block, and they did not perform that function properly. The rail control center has since issued a lessons learned to reinforce the correct procedure for securing a switch, but as a function of this, that switch was now malfunctioning. We can go to the next slide. So the next slide depicts the train 101. It entered Farragut North. It was there for approximately 7 minutes with the switch flashing. The rail control center operator, in spite of the switch failing, routed that train into the pocket track. Because the switch was failing, it had nowhere to go. So that train entered the pocket track. It went up to the signal governing the move out of it. The train operator sat there for approximately 11 minutes because they were under the impression that they were waiting for a train to come from the opposite direction, and then they were going to be routed through where the green arrow is to a single track area. It became evident pretty quickly to the Rail Control Center that they had a problem because the switch was failing and they couldn't route the train. They started attempting to raise the train via radio. We identified during post-incident and testing a couple of problems with the radio communication in the area. Number one, the call-borne radio had a loose wire, so the call-borne radio was not working. Secondary, we have taken possession of the train operator's radio. That has been sent out for bench testing. I do not have the results of that yet. I just want to point out that some of the information I'm giving to you is fluid. It may not be in a presentation because this information, as far as the call-borne radio, I received last night from the car equipment engineering report, and we did additional post-testing in the field as early as this morning, and we identified on the pocket track that you have poor communication on that pocket track because we believe we need an additional antenna on that pocket track, and that's being evaluated now. I've also requested that they also examine all of the subterranean pocket tracks to see if that problem exists anywhere else. So essentially, we're going to modify that pocket track and add an additional cable to improve communication. So at this point, the train operator becomes aware that the Rail Control Center is trying to reach him. The Rail Control Center also dispatches employees who are in the area to the train. One of them gives the radio, his radio, to the train operator. The train operator becomes aware that they want him to change ends and pull back into the Farragut North Station on the opposite track. It takes the train operator approximately 11 minutes to walk through the train because of the crowding. There was two events. There was a Nationals game and I believe some type of international hockey series that was going on. So we estimate it took about 11 minutes to get from one end to the other. During this time, as they're walking through, a track worker also identifies that an individual had self-evacuated to the track. Based upon the car equipment engineering report I received, I believe it occurred somewhere in the seventh car. Two different door panels were activated. One of them was facing a retaining wall, so they could not most probably egress from there. So then the opposite side was activated, and they appeared to have climbed down from that emergency door. An ARTRA supervisor responded as well. He boarded the train. At that point, there was a second individual who was identified to have self-evacuated. Both of these individuals were brought to the station by employees. By procedure and rule, the power should have been removed and a walk-around of the train should have occurred. That did not happen. So that is part of the examination of this investigation as well. The rail supervisor then, at that point, brought the train into Farragut North Station, and then they changed ends once again and were able to single track on track two in the normal direction that they had originally intended to proceed. So this investigation is fluid, it's ongoing, and we're trying to identify as many deficiencies as we can and correct them.
Thank you. I appreciate your including this on the agenda. It was my request, and one of the reasons was that I did not hear anything about this incident until almost 2 days later. I think that was true of most of the board members. And although there was no injury, fortunately, it was a serious incident and it got a lot of attention. And I was bothered. This is more for you, Paul. I was bothered by no notification. So I would hope in the future, if something like this occurs, that we get some kind of email or something alerting us. I don't like to read it in the post 2 days later. But that said, is it true the only communication the passengers had for those 18 minutes was the conductor attempting to walk through the cars and tell them?
I have one witness who's an employee, who's cushioning train operator. He said that one statement was made by the train operator via the PA that he was changing ends from one end to the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only information I had that the train operator on board that train had made an announcement. And we are looking at that as well.
Because that's one reason for the so-called self-evacuation, 18 minutes with no information. I have other questions, but I'll ask them later because I think we do want to move on. So, yes, Ms. Porter.
Can I ask one question here? You know, I've been on the board for almost 6 years now, and a consistent problem that we have had every time there has been some incident where passengers have been trapped on a train or they have self-evacuated, we consistently have a problem with communications. And each time this happens, we recognize communications are a problem. And the next time it happens, communications are still a problem. And this is an issue that comes up over and over again. We don't seem to know how to address it. Either the train operator doesn't give people information, doesn't give them useful information or good information, and people's reactions are often self-defeating in terms of things like self-evacuation. But we really can't expect people to act the way that we want them to act unless we give them the information that they need to act upon. And I don't know what to say at this point. We seem to be very good at dealing with infrastructure and engineering type problems. We don't seem to be very good at dealing with communications issues at all. And I don't, you know, we have got to resolve this. We can't just say, oops, someone self-evacuated when a whole train car full of people has been sitting there for, you know, almost 20 minutes without getting sufficient information. The other thing that's related to this, another area that we don't seem to be conveying information, is people seem to think that getting off a train car, the only reason not to do it is because we'll be annoyed. We somehow don't seem to be getting across to them that there is a real danger, that they, if they self-evacuate in a tunnel where we haven't turned off the power, they could die. We don't seem to have gotten that message across to them. They seem to feel that it's, you know, some silly rule that we want them to obey. We need to make a much better effort to communicate with passengers during these kinds of incidents than we have been doing for the last at least 5 years.
Thank you. Mr. Lobby?
Yeah, just a couple of observations again. I read the Washington Post articles too. They said that they didn't get any information. Some of the passengers said that. Others said that they used the emergency call button and were not able to communicate with the operator. I'm not sure if this is related to the radio system itself, but you know, I ride Metro, and often the public address system is unintelligible and the cars are just not operating at all. And certainly when we have these incidents and people say that they're not being advised, even if the operator is making the announcements in the first car, in the last car, if it's not coming over the PA, that's really an issue. So I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the operation of the public address systems on the individual cars, that they not only operate, but they're intelligible. And I'm also concerned that a train would be dispatched with a radio that had a problem like this. I assume that before you take a train out, you test the radio and you make sure that that's operating appropriately. Is that correct, Mr. Lab?
Yeah, I don't think it's really clearly defined what the test is supposed to be. So one of the things we're doing to strengthen that is prior to a train going into revenue service, they're going to have to do both a call-borne and a handheld radio check, because I think prior to that it said do a radio check. So that could mean you're handheld, but we're having them strengthen in that process by having checked both.
And one follow-up, does an operator, he has the cab radio, does he also have a handheld normally with him?
Yes, he does, and in this incident, we've taken possession of the handheld radio, and we're having it bench tested to see what the status of it is.
Thank you. Mr. Goldman, last question, please.
That was one of my questions on these conditions. The other one has to do with the track. Can we just have the incident diagram, train diagram slide again? The next one. On this one, where we see what actually happened, could the ROCC have directed the train operator of 101 to ignore the red signal and go to track 2, or was the switch actually locked in a position so that the train couldn't have made the journey from the pocket track to track 2?
I believe they could have repositioned the other switch, which is 5 switch. They could have repositioned that, and then they could have had them ignore the red signal and proceed.
Yeah.
I'd have to double check it from a traffic locking standpoint, but I don't want to go too deep into this. But I don't believe you really want to make that kind of operation if you already have poor communication and you're not clearly giving direction to the train operator. So that might have actually compounded the problem by telling them to go past a red signal if you had poor communication. It's less risky to go the other way.
I hear what you're saying, but at least in the post report, the direction from the ROCC, you know, was to go from the pocket track back to the station so that he could move to track one. At least that was in the post description of what the ROC told the train operator as the first communication.
That is a correct characterization. And once the train got into the station, they were able to then go back north in the opposite direction under signal control.
Back to the green, go back to track two.
No, go back straight where that green arrow is, straight across.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Lavin. Let's move on to the last presentation. Thank you. And if you can abbreviate it in any way, I'd appreciate it. It's important information.
All right, so this is basically we just want to give a kind of a broad overview because there's a lot of action items out there. The total number of action items is 1,063, and they consist of a variety of sources, NTSB, TOC, and FTA FTA corrective action plans, SMIs, and the TOC ones have been pretty much rolled up under the FTA ones. So, I'm sorry, just go back, and I'll do this quick. Essentially, we get an action item. We have to implement a corrective action plan. We then submit documentation to the FTA or the NTSB. If they're satisfied that that item gets closed, you can have a cap with several action items underneath it. So if you hear we close the cap, it can mean one individual item or multiple items. And a monthly report is submitted to the board. Those do not contain the recent FTA directives that came out. And I just want to point out one other thing before we move on. That number 1063 is dynamic. It can change because once the FTA directives come out and they add additional action items, that number will increase as we close things. They eventually start going down. Okay, so to date, we've submitted 655 for approval, 396 are under review, 259 are closed. The other ones, the 408, are in development. So we want to talk about the NTSB recommendations. Three of them predate the LaFont incident. One of them has to do with wayside worker or RWP protection. I just want to note that we are pursuing an FTA grant to get funding for this. With or without the grant, we're going to start pursuing this anyway. I don't want to speak specifically to which vendors we're looking at. I don't think it's appropriate in this forum, but we are looking to advance the RWP process for that recommendation. The second one has to do with the retiring of the 1,000K cars. It's my understanding that should be completed in 2017. And the last item has to do with the event recorder analysis. Now, this is a lingering recommendation that we anticipate closing at the end of this month. The reason for the delay is I believe they had some technical issues with the event recorders that had to be resolved, and you can't monitor the data from it until you resolve that issue. The last, there are 28 items associated with LaFont. Four of them were immediate action. The other 24 were issued when the report was issued. The early action items focused on ventilation state of good repair. One of those caps were submitted. That's what the asterisk denotes. The focused on tunnel ventilation procedures and training, power cable connections are properly installed. The other 24 recommendations we received on May 23rd, 2016. Chris? Thank you. The majority of those items fall into five buckets. Those are infrastructure maintenance and investments, supervision, rules and compliance, training and retraining and certification, fire life safety, emergency preparedness, operating procedures and practices. So right now we're waiting at the, these are the next steps forwards. We're waiting acceptance from the FTA, who is our federal oversight, and the NTSB on submitted action items. And we continue to work closely, we continue to work to close action items by the scheduled date. Our focus is on improving the safety and the operation of the organization. So if there's any questions. Was it fast enough?
Thank you. I'm just trying to preserve our schedule today, and it's not that we're not interested. I have a number of questions, but I will probably send them to you and ask that you respond to the committee. So I would ask others to do that unless they feel there's something they need to know today, in which case, of course, we'll listen. Are there any questions? Well, thank you very much for your cooperation. Thank you for speeding up the meeting, and the meeting is now adjourned. How about that?